This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hi, this is John. This week's episode went long, so we're splitting it into two halves. So listen this week to the first half of our interview with Phil Hack, and next week, part two. Thanks.
Welcome to this week's episode of Herding Code. This is episode number 23. This week's guest is Phil Hack. Phil recently celebrated his one-year anniversary at Microsoft, where he's a senior product manager. He's been one of the key people in getting the MVC ASP.NET MVC framework out the door, and it's currently still in beta. Phil also has a blog at hack.com, and that has two A's in it. And the number one question, Phil, about the ASP.NET MVC framework, I believe, is it still going to ship in a month that ends with B-E-R?
Well, just a slight correction. I'm a program manager, not a product manager. But so if you remember when I think Scott Hanselman perhaps was the one who kind of threw that out there, and he said whether it's November, December, January, February. So so yeah, that's a great question, really.
Excellent. Well, I mean, it's been in the making.
It's been in the making
for a little over a year now, right?
Correct.
And you guys have done a great job taking a lot of community feedback, of which there's been quite a bit on blogs and on Twitter and all over the internet, on mailing lists everywhere. But I mean, it seems like you're currently in beta now, right? So you're kind of trying to solidify some things.
Yeah. So joking aside, so we're currently targeting the end of the year. If not RTM, at least something closer to an release candidate. We have a list of bugs that were or small bugs, design changes, requests, all of this coming in via multiple channels such as the forums, random emails and such. That's been kind of a steady stream coming in. So we look through everything, try to evaluate what we want to do. Scott Gu has said on his blog, for example, that we're trying to target the end of the year, but as you know how software goes, it may well be the early next year, for example.
So, Phil, how would you – what's the elevator speech? You're talking to – you're writing with somebody that really knows web forms but doesn't know a thing about ASP.NET MVC. So what's the quick little elevator speech to let them know what it is and why they should care?
Well, if you're doing web forms and you're happy with it, I kind of say, you know, in a way you can kind of ignore MVC, right? If you're very productive with web forms, MVC is not going to replace web forms. For the web form developer, one of the nice benefits of MVC is that it really puts you in control over your application, whether it's tight control over the markup. For example, with web forms, controls can produce a lot of markup that you don't have full control over. Sometimes they might do unexpected things. Now, that's at a great benefit in terms of those things do a lot for you, but when they don't do the thing that's exactly what you want, if you really need tight control over what's produced, for example, if you're trying to build a very public web-facing site that's really dependent on good web standards, CSS-based design, this is an area where MVC has some benefits. It puts you in control. The other benefit is that the architectural pattern of Model View Controller is really great for separating concerns and building maintainable apps as well as testable apps. Testability is one of those things where when web forms first came out, it wasn't quite as prevalent in the industry. Things like unit testing and test-driven development weren't as well known as they are today. So MVC looked at that and MVC is created in that environment where it takes these things very seriously, and we're really trying to support testability as a first-class principle and goal of the framework. So that's my elevator pitch.
Okay, so a quick follow-on to that is, so, okay, this guy's convinced, excited, installs MVC, and then does what? Like, I know that there's some cool enhancements for the beta, such as adding a view from a controller and that kind of thing, that make it kind of more, you can kind of go in, add a controller, add your view, and start thinking about what you want to do. But I think a lot of the idea of MVC is that you're changing the way that you design your application as well. Like, you don't just throw a form on, you know, add a new web form and start kind of double click on it and start adding some code behind. I mean, the idea is that your thought process is different too, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So with web forms, the model is an abstraction that resembles developing a rich client app. So when web forms first came out, in a way, it really helped target VB6 developers building GUI applications. A lot of these developers were having troubles getting over to the web. So when WebForms came out, there was a huge number of VB6 developers, and a really good way to help transition them to doing web development was the WebForm model, which simulates or kind of abstracts the rich client development style. So you would drag a button, double click on the button, implement some code behind, and for the simple style apps that, you know, people were building back then, that really worked out well for the most part, but the model there with WebForms is really component control based, right? You drag these things on, you double click on them, implement event handlers, and you think of the app as almost like a rich client app, right? Everything starts with the view, the buttons, the controls, right? With interactions with those things. With MVC, it takes a more web-centric viewpoint. It realizes that, you know, the web, doing a rich client abstraction over the web is challenging. I personally think WebForms has done well, and it's great for a whole class of apps, but I feel like there's a class of apps that benefit from doing the MVC style of development, which is all interactions are really in the form of a request. And the request goes to a central controller, in our case via routing, and the controller is responsible for managing and handling that request. And then from that point, the controller will manipulate your model, and then you select a view to provide the visual rendering of the model or the representation of the model. So it's a very different style of thinking, because you really have to understand how the web works, right? You're really thinking in request response as opposed to, you know, button click, you know, selected item changed, right? If that makes any sense.
Right.
So speaking of web forms, so web forms have always traditionally had your declarative markup in an ASPX file where you sort of describe the user interface, and then a code behind file that was associated with that, with the event handlers and the page lifecycle events where you could perform some work. And that's still present in the MVC framework. It's still built on ASP.NET, so you can still have a web form with a code behind. But there's a lot of people that feel that code behind file should never be there. And I was wondering how you felt about that.
Yeah, so technically with our view engine, the web form view engine, you could drag a server run at form run at equals server and drag controls and on there, but it wouldn't fit the model because all your application logic is in the controllers, right, which runs before the view is rendered. So in general, the MVC model is that there's no postbacks, there's no view state, there's no control model. Now, with regards to the code behind, the reason we have a code behind is that we have two ways you can do a view. You can do it just inherit from view page, or you can have a strongly typed view. To do a strongly typed view without the code behind is a real pain. So on that regards, we have the code behind. Also, the code behind, it isn't, in my opinion, This is, it's kind of interesting. People don't call MVC opinionated software like other platforms, but I certainly do have some opinions, right? And they do manifest themselves in there. But people don't call it opinionated unless it matches their opinions of what should happen, right? So in this case, my opinion is that the code behind, it's valid to put some code in there, but the type of code would be view code. Case in point, if you have some helper properties specific to that view that just make your view cleaner, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with putting it in the code behind. Now, if you have plans to use alternate view engines, it may well be better to use a helper method so that you can reuse it. But my point being is that there's nothing fundamental in the MVC pattern that says you can't have a code that's view specific in the view, right? That's the whole point of the separation of concerns. As long as the code there is view code, it's fine to be there. Now, from a pragmatic, practical perspective, you want to avoid having too much code in your view because the views are the hardest part to test. So the aspect where people say, view should have no code, is not to do with the pattern. It's more to do with practical aspects. The other aspect of it, though, is that the other concern that people have with the code behind it, and this is a valid concern, is the fact that they are concerned that people are going to abuse it, that they're going to put too much code. One guy was at some talk, and somebody put link to SQL code in the code behind in the view. And, all hell broke loose. demons came and ate children and stuff like that. So, we don't condone that. That's not a valid use of the pattern. My point has been, no matter what we do, people can do the wrong thing. For example, do we also get rid of the script run at equals server tag in the view because people can put code in there? Oh, shoot, what about the less than percent? I mean, if you're really concerned about this, use an alternate view engine that's truly a templating engine, right? I think in the future, if we have more resources to invest in the view, we may well look at ways to specify strongly tied view such that you don't need the code behind. That would be something I would really like to have. For 1.0, we probably won't have that. The other aspect is there may be other reasons why you want to use the code behind that's specific to the WebForm view engine that doesn't apply to other view engines, where those view engines might have to come up with their own way of doing it. Substitution control is one example where if you're using output caching and you want to use a substitution control, you're going to have to put a method in the code behind. Now, there are people out there like Steve Sanderson who has a great blog. He's been creating his own versions of output caching and substitution controls that are MVC friendly. So those approaches are great too, and those will be stuff we'll be looking at. But like I said, I think there's a lot of confusion or conflating of the model view controller pattern and particular implementations of it. So yeah, code in the code behind is bad if it's not view code, but it's fine if it's view code. Although our general recommendation is to use helper methods, and you can't go wrong with that.
Scott Kuhn, you had a question?
Yes. So this was back a little while, a couple of minutes ago, when you'd mentioned that the code in the view was the hardest to test. And I was thinking of it from the standard line of business developer, the guy who's working on the intranet at bigcorp.com or, some huge corporation is just working on, an app that's going to be used by a few people. And generally the view is the hardest to test, but it's also the easiest to change when you need to make a very specific change in the business logic. Say, some field on a form needs to be required or not required depending on who the logged in user is. And I was wondering how it seems like there's a lot more work that goes into those kinds of very small changes at that level in MVC than there are in the traditional web forms where you have a lot of business logic in the view and the code behind. And I'm just wondering if there's any kind of validity to that kind of thinking, or, you know, if everyone should just, you know, immediately stop what they're doing and make changes to their model and their controller and switch everything over when they need to, you know, make sure a checkbox is, you know, always set by default to checked, or, you know, is required or not required.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, part of the reason why views are harder to test in general is that they are the things that experience the most churn, right? When you write a unit test or various tests for your model objects or your controller, in general, the amount of churn that those tests will undergo is much less than your view, because your view is easier to change, so it often changes a lot. I mean, I've had, remember in the consulting days, having clients who, you know, would spend days, you know, wanting to move things. Oh, let's move it a pixel to the right. No, let's move it a pixel to the left. No, let's move it a pixel up. That sort of thing. So in terms of something where it's the you want to show something is required or not required based on the authenticated user, personally, I really feel like that the logic for determining that should be in the controller, and the view should just the controller should just set something that tells the view to check this and show something or not show something, right? Occasionally, you know, it is convenient to cheat when you need to make a really quick change. The problem is, if that's important logic, and in this case, if it's security logic, you'd be better served by having something that you could easily automate and test. So doing something like that, I really think, go through the process of changing your controller and having a unit test that confirms that behavior. Now, if it's a difference of you know, tweaking the way that the view looks in terms of I'm going to move this thing to the left and that thing to the right, obviously that is purely view. There's no need to go to the controller to say, oh, you know, move the sidebar from the left to the right, right? That, I think, stays in the view and is totally fine.
So this may be kind of a general question to throw out to everybody there. And we've kind of covered this a little bit last week, I think, when we talked about real-world development, but, you know, get some different perspectives on it. So what's the threshold, I guess, for having unit testing in your applications? I mean, so if I'm writing a quick one-off survey for an intranet, do I need to have everything unit tested, or can I just use MVC? You know, just to get something up, I have a single model, I have a single view. Maybe I have two views. I have results and I have, you know, questions or something. And I ask that because, you know, the way that Rails got sold initially was the 15-minute blog video that everybody saw. And, you know, the 15-minute blog video didn't include unit tests. It didn't include, you know, a lot of things that go into making an app a little bit more stable or robust or handle different scenarios. And so I'm just wondering if there's an importance threshold for software, or if, you know, all software is so blindingly important that there must be unit tests for every single line of code.
Well, when I write Hello World console app, that thing is so important that I have unit tests, fitness tests, acceptance tests. I have a QA staff ready to test my Hello World console app. So I don't know about the kind of apps you're writing, Scott, but my apps, they're damn important.
Well, ironically, those are the only kind of apps that I ever see get tested because they're demo code for articles or something.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so, I mean, in all seriousness, one mantra that I hear, give a shout out to Brad Wilson, who's on the ASP.NET team. He always says, I don't unit test prototype code. Now, one of the things, you know, I want to call out here is that if we're talking about unit testing, like from a TDD sense of the word, test-driven development, we have to keep in mind that TDD is not a testing activity. It's a design activity. So from that regards, like, it helps you shape the APIs, right? You're always writing code that's a client to the classes that you're writing. It's really a design process. Now, if you're writing something that you've written before or you've already known and it's really small, like the intranet survey app, and it's one table or two tables, and, you know, it takes you like, you know, half an hour, then yeah. So if I'm building a simple, well-known app, I already know the design of the code, even at the code level in my head, and it's really small. Yeah, I might not resort to TDD. In general, though, I feel like once you get used to doing TDD, it's a bit of a discipline. But once you get used to taking that approach to building apps, even for sample apps, I find it really hard not to do TDD. When I was first started off as working on the MVC project, I built a lot of little sample apps. And most of those samples, even just samples of like how do you do this or that, I included unit tests because they helped me think through how would somebody interact with this. Because these were samples I was thinking of putting on my blog and saying, this is how you do X with MVC. So I wanted unit tests to say, well, if someone's doing X, what is their code going to look like, right? So in that regard, I feel like it can be used in many, many situations, not just, you know, your big, you know, long-term maintainable app. But I do also see if you're building a throwaway prototype, you know, you might not do it. Like a lot of times you'll see demos, you know, when you mentioned the Rails video. Well, a video where he built that blog the way he probably would have really built it in real life with the full unit testing doesn't make for a good video, right? It's not good marketing. So when I give a talk and I show sample app building, I'm not going to spend the time to go through all the TDD steps because I usually only have an hour and 15 minutes allocated. So for a really small app, you don't get the sort of economy of scale that TDD buys you. I really feel in the long term, over the life cycle of a real application that you're building, I personally feel that TDD will buy you time, will actually decrease the overall time because you spend less time tracking down bugs. But in a short, like 1 hour demo, obviously it does incur overhead that doesn't make for a good demo video.
So we're talking about unit testing. I think that's kind of a natural time to ask about the work that you guys did to make the adding testing in a smooth experience. So one obvious thing is when you create a new project, it says, you know, would you like to add tests? And then it allows you to create a test project using whatever unit test frameworks you've got installed.
Sure. So one of the like larger goals that we have with MVC, aside from testing, is that we're trying to help people sort of provide prescriptive guidance. You know, when you start a typical project template, there's really this sense of, okay, WTF, what do I do now? So kind of going back to an earlier question you had, you know, how would someone who did file new or who's coming from web forms and is doing file new on MVC, how do they understand the mindset? Well, one aspect of it is that we start off with a full application. Roughly, the default template is a full application that you can kind of see the see how controllers and actions and views are put together. So, but more specifically, in terms of testing, you know, the test dialog that you mentioned, that was one big aspect where we really wanted to make sure that third-party unit test providers could hook into the dialog and have their unit test framework listed in there. So, you know, you'll see MB unit, N unit, xunit.net. There's installers available for all three of those that will show up in that dialog. The other aspect, though, is really the most important aspect is the APIs, the class designs. So the framework design guidelines has one of these rules of basically don't make methods virtual unless you have a really good reason to. We sort of flipped that on its head for the MVC project and said don't make a method non-virtual or sealed unless you have a really good reason to. So we've tried to keep things virtual and we've tried to keep things either abstract or interface based. And most importantly, though, is we spent a lot of time building apps where we built the apps using a TDD or writing a lot of unit tests. Because early on, around preview 2, I think, we got a lot of negative feedback about how hard it was to test apps. And while we internally had really good test coverage of the underlying framework. One of those lessons that we learned is that testing your when you're developing a framework, it's very different from developing an app. When you develop a framework, the fact that you have test coverage of your framework doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy to test for those using your framework. So one of the aspects we did is we went through and we did a lot of testing ourselves, and I firsthand experienced the pain. And sometimes we kind of have a blind eye to the pain because we'll write our own little helpers for that. But the fact that we had to write so many helpers is one of those code smells. So we went through, and I think in preview 3, we introduced the action result along with many other refactorings. And we had tremendous positive feedback from those changes. So that's another area where we were focusing on testability.
Kevin, you have a question?
Oh, well, it's just kind of a amendment to that comment. I've noticed that, for example, one of the things that have changed over the course of the CTPs was that the need for doing things like partial mocks and mocks in general has kind of reduced over time, which seems like a sort of a targeted making testability easier. Was that like a really deliberate part of that investigation?
Yes, definitely. It's kind of funny because if you've read my blog, you know I'm a big fan of mock frameworks and using mocking. So I think part of the issue was I always felt, well, the fact that you have to mock this or mock that isn't a problem. You know, like, what's the big deal? What does anyone have against mocks? But it's interesting because a lot of those changes, many of those changes were actually driven by Scott Goo, who said, yeah, you know, mocking is great, but if you don't need to do it, you know, let's not make it required, right? So we did a lot of efforts, and fundamentally, as I thought about it more, it really made sense to me. The theme that I kind of lumped that under is not just improving testability, but the fact is that your controller actions really ought to focus on the logic of your application, on the logic to handle the user input, and should have almost as little tie or coupling to the underlying framework as possible. And what I mean by that is, for example, whereas before you would have to pretty much response.write via a render view method, you're basically response.writing, or you would call response.redirect within an action method. Now you just return this action result, whether it's a redirect result or whether it's the view result. And the result is responsible for calling into the underlying plumbing, the HTTP context and the requests and stuff, in order to do the actual redirects. So there may be cases where your action method still has to touch, you know, the request, the response. But in many respects, more and more, it really doesn't need to know about, it doesn't need to call into those things. So with that regard, your action methods really are less coupled to the underlying framework, which has the real big benefit of making unit testing easier, so you don't have to mock the HTTP context every single time. So that was, and back to John's question, that was another thing, is we created these abstract base classes for the existing HTTP intrinsics, you know, which, you know, if we could go back without breaking anything and change those original ones, that would have been a great thing to do. But MVC is completely built on top of ASP.NET without making any changes to the core system.web assemblies.
So doesn't sealing a method kind of enforce your opinion in your opinionated framework?
Sealing a method is basically saying that you have no reason to ever override this method, in part because I can't think of one. There are occasional valid cases for sealing a method, right? I think examples might be for performance reasons. You might do it for certain types of security reasons. You might do it. If you're doing a template method pattern, you're going to have some methods that are sealed, but they'll call into the virtual methods that, you know, form the template. So I guess you could say it forms an opinion, but I don't know what that opinion is. I mean, I think, like, what did you mean by that?
Well, it's not that it forms an opinion of itself. It's just that, you know, when you're designing opinionated software, you're saying, you know, this is the way you should do things, and this is, more importantly, this is the way you should not do things. And so sealing the class pretty much says, you know, this class is fine just the way it is. Use it.
Right, but another opinion might be that, you know, this class is ready to be extended by you or overridden by you, right? I mean, one of the opinions we... What?
That's not my opinion. That opinion is wrong. that's part of the opinionation. So, I mean, there is no such thing as a sealed class in Ruby.
Right.
And Rails pretty much has gatekeepers. You know, not everyone gets to commit to the trunk, and not every feature makes it in. It goes to the DHH quality gate, let's say.
Well, that has nothing to do with sealing, though, right? Like, so in Ruby, it's a dynamic language, so whether you have commit access to Rails or not is irrelevant to the fact that you can go and monkey patch any of the classes that are currently in there.
Yeah, that's right. That's apples and oranges.
Yeah. So with MVC, you know, we're built on the CLR, so CLR compliant languages such as VB.NET and C#. You can't quite monkey patch anything just yet, but if we keep things virtual, then we are saying to you, hey, look, this is meant to be overridden. We've had cases in the early previews where people reported back to us that they were able to work around early bugs that we had in the product because of the extensibility of the system, the fact that they could override certain methods and have them do something else. So, you know, even though we shipped the source code with a license that allowed you to modify it, for the most part, we've heard from people that they didn't need to modify the code because of extensibility. Like, we really wanted MVC to be completely extensible in such a way that you could take any layer and totally swap it out. So if you don't like the WebForm view engine, then you can swap it out, use something like Envelocity or Enamel or just some new one that looks pretty cool. I forgot the name of it, like Spike or something. Or if you don't, you know, want to use our default controller factory, you can hook in, you know, controller factories that use any your dependency injection framework of choice, whether it's, you know, Structure Map or Castle or Ninject. I have to list them all, or people get upset that I neglected their dependency injection framework. Since seems like everyone out there has one now.
My second one is actually kind of tied to a question that Evan Hoff kind of sent in. He had asked about does MS stress test MVC? What does that look like? And mine kind of ties into that in terms of, you know, when you were developing the framework, you said, you know, you tried to look at it from not just the is the framework testable point of view, but also is the code that's going to be written using the framework going to be testable, you know, or able to be tested without having to mock the entire world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering how much dog fooding has been done internally that you can talk about. You know, are other teams within, you know, DevDiv or other groups, are they starting to adopt it when they're building out, you know, web properties? Are you seeing vendors, you know, use MVC when they're building new marketing sites, anything like that?
So this sounds like two different questions. So one is, are we stress testing MVC? Yeah, we have a suite of stress tests. I don't have any specific details on that other than pretty much everything that we do undergoes stress testing as far as the ASP.NET team goes. I mean, I assume all teams do it, but my only experience is with the ASP.NET team. And usually that involves like hammering certain methods or pages or apps for long periods of time over and over just to see if anything breaks down after being hammered for so long. We also do performance tests. So we keep a distinction between stress tests and performance tests. The stress is really just how does the framework and the app hold up under a lot of stress? You know, is there memory leaks, yada, yada. Whereas perf, we also do perf tests to see, you know, how fast are the features and how fast are they compared to previous versions. Since MVC is a version 1 property, a lot of our baseline comparisons are web form scenarios. So we'll compare, like, how does MVC compared to the roughly equivalent web form scenarios, which is a bit of an art because, you know, it's really hard to determine what those scenarios are. The second question you asked, what was that again?
So, yeah, so kind of a dog fooding, you know.
Dog fooding. Sorry, yeah.
So how are vendors starting to use it more when they're building out MS, you know, .com properties or marketing sites or yada, yada, yada?
Yeah, I only have anecdotes, but so CodePlex.com has moved portions of their site to MVC. And so they're a great example of a site that uses both WebForms and MVC. And I believe their intention is to move a lot more of it to MVC, although you'd have to talk to them. I do get emails from all sorts of teams internal. I probably can't name them all, but probably because I can't remember them all. But I do get a lot of emails from a lot of teams internally asking about it, planning to develop with it. We get a lot of emails from various external people who are planning to, who are starting to develop in it. So I'm getting a lot of emails, some from fairly large corporations who have what I would consider a more conservative, you know, big website, big architecture, who I was actually surprised to hear about. But it kind of makes sense in that they have a very rich architectural focus. So to them, they see MVC as sort of fitting that. So I am seeing a lot of interest in it, although, you know, I can't really gauge like at what level that is, you know what I mean? Because to me, it's selection bias. Like I don't hear about all the people who, you know, took a look at it and said, nah.
So we previously on the podcast, we talked to Jeff Atwood over at, formerly of Coding Horror, now of Stack Overflow. And he's obviously, Stack Overflow is obviously one of the more prominent initial MVC users. And he had nothing but good things to say about it. I'm wondering if there are any other public sites that we might know about that you... that you could tell us, you know, are built on MVC.
Okay, if you go to greparty.com or greatvocab.com, this is a public site built on MVC where they decided to just stick with the default template that comes out of the when you do a file new MVC project. So I thought that was kind of interesting. I recommend if you're going to stick with the default template, at least change the background cover. I know the Lounge, which is a site done by James Avery, that's MVC, and I think the idea behind is Stack Overflow is one of my favorite public sites built on MVC. I remember when Jeff first announced that he was doing this joint venture with Joel Spolsky, and I called him up and I said, you know, my first question is, dude, what are you going to develop this in? Please tell me it's not Wasabi. Please tell me it's MVC. So they had already been talking about MVC and using it. So I was pretty excited when he said that, because I figured whatever he's going to do is going to come out pretty good. And also just the more showcase sites that are out there, especially sites that really are interesting and do a lot of stuff, such that it provides a real source of feedback. So from Jeff, for example, in Stack Overflow, we've gotten a lot of feedback about we need to make caching easier to do with MVC. So this is stuff that we're looking at.
Partial caching especially, right? I think that was the thing where they were like, it's easy enough to mark a controller action as cacheable, but if you've got kind of sub-actions or if you're composing a page out of a lot of things, it's hard to say cache just this part of the page, but allow, you know, this other area where I'm showing this user information, don't cache that sort of thing. Is that an accurate way of describing
it? Right. So with the WebForm View Engine, that's actually possible right now. And I talked with Jeff over the phone with a possible solution to that. But at the time, he already had a working solution of his own. So I don't know if it makes sense for him to change it right this second. Although, since we'll both be at the PDC, I'll leave it open to him. We can do a little code pair programming session and try out the idea. But the idea is basically to use substitution controls. It's not ideal, but it does the job, and we can take that experience and look at how to make it even better with MVC.
So when you mentioned substitution controls, that reminded me of another question I've had out there, which is just what's the control story for MVC? Is that just kind of, I mean, I know part of the idea of controls is that they encapsulate, you know, view model and controller kind of, and so it kind of fights the model of MVC. Is there a way that third parties or whatever can develop a control?
That's the big question, isn't it? I mean, so like you said, one thing we are not trying to do is do controls in a non-MVC way. So this whole idea of drag a control onto a page and that single control encapsulates both the view and the behavior and all that stuff, that won't even work with MVC. That doesn't work with the pattern. So the challenge there is that no matter what you do, there's going to be some part that's in the controller arena, like bag, and some part that's in the view. So we're working with a lot of the component vendors to talk about what are ways to do that, and you know they all have ideas. So me and the lead dev are planning to put together some guidelines and some thoughts on this, and some practical or some prototype implementations. For the most part, my feeling is the way that you'll see this go, and kind of like my gut check recommendation is to do a lot of the view in JavaScript. We include jQuery now, so you can use jQuery, use it with Microsoft Ajax if you want. Build out some kind of JavaScript control that encapsulates the GUI, and like if you're doing some sort of grid control, I would do it almost completely in JavaScript and just make Ajax calls to an action method that returns JSON.
So Brad Wilson had mentioned earlier that that by default the default view has a doc type of XHTML rather than HTML. I was wondering why. Do you just like to punish devs?
That's a good question.
I have distinct opinions about XHTML versus HTML.
Yeah, no matter what we choose, we're going to get people complaining about it. So it's a challenging choice. I mean, I think we took that what's newer, and we picked that, right? HTML 4.01, the RFC was released in 1999, and XHTML, the RFC was released in 2000. So yeah, we picked the shiny one.
All right, there was another question from a listener. Wanted to know if you might be coming out with any best practices for migrating an existing ASP.NET site. Not that anyone must migrate their web forms ASP.NET site, but if someone did want to move from web forms to MVC, will there be anything to help them out?
That's a good question. I mean, my short answer is if it's working for you, don't. My medium answer is, if you still insist on doing it, focus on new functionalities, new areas of the site, and do those in MVC and leave the rest in web forms. It doesn't seem to me that it's really cost effective to port a working existing site to MVC. One thing I'd love to do at some point is to meet up with the Codeplex guys, because they're very much doing this, and they probably have really good insight and guidance based on a real-world migration. I've talked with them about how they've had cases where they'll have the same master page for both web form views and their web form, or for MVC web form views and for their web form pages. So they ran into a lot of tricky issues that they had to solve. So for the most part, it would be great to work with them to do that. I'm not promising anything, but now that you mention it, I think I will touch base with them to talk about maybe collaborating on some sort of white paper or just whatever the form it should take.
All right, that's it for part one. Catch us next week for the second part of our interview with Phil Hack.